The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Welcome to all the folks who come a little late. I think, as many of you know, teachers are asked to come up with these topics far in advance of when we're actually going to be speaking. Common Ground is all about prepare, prepare, prepare. And so I came up with what I thought was a pretty cool title, Transforming Anger, Happiness as an Antidote, because I really wanted to talk about happiness. But Mark said, no, you got to talk about anger too. So I said, okay. So as I worked on it and tried to incorporate these two together, I actually found that a better title would be Preventing Anger, Happiness as a Prophylactic or a Preventive Measure. So that's the way we're going to approach it tonight. One of the criticisms of Buddhism is that it's all about suffering, and who the heck wants to spend all their time studying about suffering? But since there is so much suffering in it, it seems to be appropriate to talk about transforming anger as a means to address that suffering. But happiness? What does happiness have to do with ending suffering? Actually, there is a lot in Buddhism about happiness. So much so, in fact, that I think the Buddha's first draft of the Four Noble Truths addressed happiness, as in, there is happiness in the world, there's a cause of happiness, there's unending happiness, and there's a path to unending happiness. But then he thought about it a little more and thought, geez, I don't want to promise too much. So he hedges bet a bit to only promise the end of suffering without guaranteeing happiness. But as we will see, though, ending suffering may lead to happiness. So what are we talking about with this term anger in this context? Well, one of the important perspectives on it is that it be seen as a being in a spectrum from minor irritation to uncontrollable rage. Some of you may have heard this story already, but it was very important to me, so I'm going to repeat it again. As a parent, I had this pointed out to me when my son was about 4 years old, and he would say to me, "Dad, you're so angry." And I didn't think I was being angry at all. And I would say on a couple of occasions, but I learned this didn't work so well, to say, "You think that's anger? You want to hear what anger is like?" And then I realized, maybe I am angry after all. So in those situations, I felt like my son was accusing me, and I was no doubt in a defensive mode. The Dalai Lama, in his book, Healing Anger, points out that there are several afflictive emotions in Buddhism, and they include jealousy, conceit, lust, and closed-mindedness. Hatred or anger is singled out as the worst. The Dalai Lama points out that in the Tibetan language, they have just one word that means both hatred and anger. And he distinguishes hatred from anger because he believes that anger can, in special circumstances, be positive, whereas hatred can never be. And this fits with our approach to approaching anger as a continuum, with hatred as an extreme form. So anger and hatred are considered the worst of the afflictive emotions for two reasons. One is that it's the greatest obstacle to a practitioner obtaining a sense of altruism or a good heart. The other is that hatred and anger are hatred and anger are generated, they have the capacity to destroy one's virtue and calmness of mind. And as we will see, that is akin to eliminating any opportunity for happiness. The Dalai Lama suggests that it may be helpful to note how anger or hateful thoughts arise. He says that frequently they arise when we experience a feeling of hurt, when we feel that we have been unfairly treated by someone. And here the use of the term "we" is very appropriate, because oftentimes the harm may not be just to us, but to some one of our senses of community, such as in our current political situation. The Dalai Lama says, if we examine carefully the way that anger has arisen, you sense that it comes as a protector, as a friend, to help you do battle or take revenge against the harm inflicted. So the anger or hateful thought appears to come as a friend or a protector. Now, this may sound a little strange, but I want you to think a little bit about how you feel when you're experiencing righteous anger. I think that's what he's talking about here. But it's actually an illusion. Hatred and anger are not shields or protectors. The harm has already been done. There is no need for a shield or protector. Seeking revenge or otherwise acting out from anger cannot prevent what has already occurred. It seems to me that there's a corollary to this as well. As anger arises, it assumes a vulnerable me who can be hurt. We'll be talking later about how personalizing anger or anything is also illusory. And on a more humorous note, there's a great metaphor for what happens when we do act out our anger. It says, when we let anger drive our bus, it kicks off all the other emotions and heads for the potholes. And now I have a couple of quotes to show that there are varied approaches to anger from very learned people. Buddha describes anger as being, with its poisoned source and fevered climax, murderously sweet, that you must slay to weep no more. And there again, it kind of sounds like righteous anger, with the fevered climax that's murderously sweet. But it seems to be suggesting that we repress our anger by saying that we must slay it. But if we remember that the Buddha came from a warrior clan, the slaying language may be more appropriately understood as transforming in our culture. Anger must be something that we must transform to weep no more. Jack Kornfield takes another approach. He says, we can find gold in our anger and judgment, for in them is the wisdom of justice and integrity. When we work with anger, it can be a valuable medicine. Transformed anger can give us judgment and clarity to see what needs to be done, what limits need to be set. And it seems to me this could be one of the positive aspects of anger that the Dalai Lama was referencing earlier when he distinguished anger from hatred. And for me, it provides hope that anger is not a dead end, that we can transform it to develop skillful means, or I would submit, use it to better understand and maintain a sense of happiness. Another aspect of anger that I've been thinking about is that it involves finding the present moment unacceptable, demanding that things be different. I'm one of the teachers of the mindfulness recovery in the 12-step groups here, and I've had the opportunity to quote one of Bill W.'s statements in the Big Book, which says, everybody knows the difference between a simple desire and a demand. And I didn't. I didn't understand. What's the difference between a simple desire and demand? I just couldn't get it. But after I thought about it some more, and when I consider it in the context of my inner state, I think a desire is just something that's similar to having a preference for something. It'd be nice if I got it now, but if I don't, that's okay too. A demand reflects that something in the present moment is unacceptable and must be changed. For example, suppose you want an ice cream cone with 2 scoops. Well, I'd say that's desire. But let's say everybody else is getting an ice cream cone with 2 scoops and you only get an ice cream cone with 1. If it were me, I would be angry and demanding a second scoop immediately because it just wasn't fair. And that would be the difference between a demand and a simple desire. Or in the context of relationship and control issues, and this again is something that I've experienced as well as ice cream, it would be wishing our partner would start to put things back where they belong at some point. Now that would be a desire, unvoiced especially. A demand would be to require that in the present moment our partner put something back where it belongs. And my sense and experience is that this would generally be viewed by the partner as anger. So again, we see the difference between a simple desire that something happen in the future and a demand. In the present moment, this has to happen. So those are some reflections on anger. And now we'll talk a little bit about happiness before we try to put the two together. So first thing I want to point out is that happiness is different from pleasure. Happiness is an emotion that arises in our mind, although we may experience it in our body. Pleasure arises in the other five senses. Also, we can do things that we know will provide us pleasure. I'll let you fill in the blank there. It is almost as if we can will ourselves to have pleasure by satisfying one or more of our senses in the present moment. Happiness cannot be willed. It is like love. We can put in place the causes and conditions that may lead to happiness, but there are no guarantees. Perhaps this may be why we seek pleasure so much. It is easier to achieve and gives us a sense of control. Another way to look at happiness is provided by Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche in The Joy of Living, Unlocking the Secret and Science of Happiness. He talks about happiness by distinguishing between the psychological concepts of states of mind and personality traits. He says that a state of mind is transitory, as in giddy happiness or pleasure. A personality trait is generally quite long-lasting and characterizes who we are. It is our stable or default emotional mode of being. Now, neuroscience has determined that these personality traits are not permanent. They say that our mind has the quality of plasticity, which means that in a sense, it can be molded, and even basic personality traits can change. This does take a lot of practice to get our neurons and neurotransmitters to operate in different sequences with enough frequency to allow this change to happen. But this is very good news because it means that if our current default personality trait is anxiety, worry, or pessimism, it can be changed to happiness, although it will definitely take a while. And for some, that won't be the case due to chemical imbalances in the brain. I have those chemical imbalances and take some medications for those and find that that helps, but also this practice helps immeasurably as well. So what is happiness? Rinpoche relates it to what is called the direct experience of nature mind, which we all experience from time to time. For example, for many it might be about being in nature on a mountain or near a lake. For others, it might be seeing a young child playing or seeing a baby sleeping. Often it is characterized by an almost absence of conscious thought. In my experience, when I'm in the Boundary Waters, for instance, somebody might come up to me and say, "Well, what are you thinking about, Emil?" I'd say, "Nothing special." But the reality is we have 50 to 70,000 thoughts a day going through our minds. And they don't stop when you have that experience of nature mind. It's just that your conscious awareness is here and now, and they're just rolling through like a river. So at its best, when we're experiencing this nature mind, there is a feeling of absolute well-being that radiates through all physical, emotional, and mental states. And that is what we are aware of, not the thoughts that, as I said, continue to flow like a river. It is said to be an experience that is immeasurably peaceful, and when repeated over and over, can become virtually unshakable. It is referred to as being happy for no reasons, and involves being totally in the moment without a need to create stories about what we are experiencing. And it reminds me of a blessing from Southwest Native American tradition. I think it's the Navajo, but I'm not sure. It goes, "May you walk in beauty," which I translate to mean, "May you be so in the present moment that you are just aware of the amazingness of the existence and the beauty that is all about you all the time." Last summer, I experienced happiness for no reason at our somewhat isolated cabin in the Superior National Forest. I had been troubled by a pinched nerve in my neck that caused pain in my shoulder and arm. I got a steroid injection and some physical therapy, which relieved most of the pain. And one day, I realized something had changed. I was just feeling happy, despite the fact that our long to-do list at this old homestead, which had been weighing on me, hadn't changed in the least bit. I continued to plug away at those tasks and felt very peaceful and at ease for no apparent reason. The tasks no longer felt like something I had to do. They were more like things to do as I experienced and enjoyed all that was around me. I had previously been unable to see the beauty and joyful expression of nature on a regular basis. This continued for much of the next few days, and when it ended, I decided to ask myself, when I'm not happy, what is getting in the way of experiencing happiness? And for me, there have been both external and internal interferences to experiencing happiness. From an external perspective, I think that inability to experience happiness results from our toxic materialistic culture being in conflict with what I think is our basic Buddha nature of generosity, integrity, and compassion. It's as though the world out there almost wants to beat all those qualities out of us. And it's hard to be feeling happy when you're caught up in that conflict. Internally, as I said earlier, I'm treated for low-level depression, and this manifests from time to time as doubt that this path is doing any good or that things will get any better. And by the way, doubt was identified by the Buddha as the most pernicious of the five hindrances or mental factors that hinder progress in meditation and in our daily lives. Depression also manifests as low self-esteem, which from a Buddhist perspective involves deluding ourselves by believing false thoughts about ourselves. I also experience negative thinking as a result of depression. But I don't think you need a clinical diagnosis to experience these mind states. Though, and of course, those external factors can trigger the internal ones. So the question becomes, what to do when this occurs? When I am able to develop awareness of these distressing mind states, I remind myself that this is suffering, and that people all over the world are experiencing similar mind states. This helps to depersonalize the experience and the feeling, and by not seeing it as part of me, but just as something being experienced, the feeling often subsides, and this provides the opportunity for happiness to arise. Now, this strategy I'm suggesting carries an assumption. And that assumption is that it's a reasonable expectation to be happy as our primary or default emotion. And some of us might call that into question. The Dalai Lama would say that it is in our nature, as shown by his famous quote, "All beings just want to be happy." This underlines the importance of happiness in Buddhism, and it also is helpful to remember when we are angry and wondering how someone could do something that appears to be so obviously harmful or idiotic, etc., etc. The Dalai Lama's point is that with the causes and conditions then operating on that person, his or her action was, in their mind, the most rational step available to achieve happiness or less suffering in that moment. So to that extent, we are all the same, all wanting happiness, only the causes and conditions operating on us are different and may lead to more or less idiotic behaviors. Now, this concept was dramatically pointed out to me by a mostly humorous YouTube video by Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico. In it, he is seated at a desk and purports to be speaking directly to the guy he calls the president of the Electoral College of the United States of America. He trashes the president's proposal for a wall and the president himself for a few minutes. My favorite is when he says that he has searched the dark web and found a schematic for a technological fix to defeat the wall. He pulls out what appears to be a second grader's drawing of a ladder, points to it, and points out that a $25 ladder will defeat the $25 billion wall. After he finishes his diatribe, he shifts gears. He pulls out a picture of a little boy. He asks Donald if he recognized the little boy. Then he says, "It is you. Before you were you. Instead of building a wall, Donald, build a bridge across the oceans of time and walk back across it to find this small boy and tell him that just because his father does not love him, does not mean he cannot love the world." Well, as you can see, this impacted me significantly. I think it was because of the juxtaposition of a humorous rant with the wonderful statement implying that we're all the same, just different in the causes and conditions we've experienced. So now we get to the real question. How do we achieve happiness? Well, back in the day, we could have asked the Buddha. And there is a story about this in a book called Drop by Drop, The Buddha's Path to True Happiness by the Venerable Bhikkhu Buddharakhita. I tell you, I got to practice that one. So it goes like this. A man said to the Buddha, "I want happiness." And the Buddha said, "Well, first remove the I. That's ego. Then remove want. That's desire. Now you are left with only happiness." Now the online site Fake Buddha Quotes argues pretty convincingly that this is a fake because it wouldn't make any sense in the Pali language, which was the language of the Buddha, but I like it, so I'm going to believe they just didn't quite get the quote exactly right, and besides, it works. So what is this about removing wanting? Well, that's something I've been working on. It started with my need to understand things. I thought that I could think my way out of my problems. But it turned out my best thinking was frequently what caused the problems. But I fully believed that by understanding the situation better, if I could just get my arms around these 12 steps, everything would be okay when I was in recovery. Thankfully, my counselor didn't laugh. Once I became aware of this delusion, I then became aware of how much of my time was spent not having to know things, but just wanting things, such as imagining when I'd be able to get my next hit of chocolate or ice cream or be able to watch a hockey game or just take a nap. And I found out that was taking up a lot of time and getting in the way of happiness, because when you're imagining something, wanting something, you can't be in the present moment and experiencing the beauty that is in all of existence. So that prevented me from experiencing the happiness inherent in the present moment. So I got what the Buddha was saying in that quote of let go of the wanting. Removing the I is about one of the three marks of existence cited by the Buddha. This is one is called emptiness. Excuse me. This one is called emptiness or non-self. The others are impermanence and suffering or unsatisfactoriness, but we're not going to go there tonight. About emptiness, books have been written on this topic, such as one currently being discussed in our weekly practice groups with Mark and Shelley, and will be continued to be discussed over a period of several months. I have been discussing emptiness in other terms up to now, and I'm hoping that it will suffice to say that emptiness means all conditioned things are empty of a permanent, stable existence, including us. This means that there is no me or self or I in here. Instead, our existence consists of a series of experiential events, like thinking, talking, or in my early example when I said I'm experiencing suffering, just suffering. Other examples are moving, remembering, thinking. One person on learning about emptiness said, oh, I get it. I'm a gerund. For those who don't remember everything from seventh grade English, a gerund is a verb in its ing form when it is used as a noun, as for instance, I am seeing people. Because there is no I in the ultimate reality context of emptiness, however, this would be said as there is an experience of seeing people or just seeing people. While this may feel like just a word game, the Buddha identified realizing emptiness as a gate to liberation or enlightenment, or nibbana. One of the suttas is concerned with Bahiya's meeting with the Buddha and the Buddha's response to Bahiya's urgent pleading to teach him how to truly enter the great way of freedom and happiness. The Buddha said, Bahiya, this is how you should train yourself. Whenever you see a form, simply see. Whenever you hear a sound, simply hear. Whenever you taste a flavor, simply taste. Whenever you feel a sensation, simply feel. Whenever a thought arises, let it simply be a thought. Then you will not exist. Whenever you do not exist, you will not be found in this world, another world, or in between. That is the end of suffering. The corollary is that we suffer or we are not happy because we don't experience our lives in this manner. Instead, we create stories about our experiences that feel real because we falsely believe there is an I or a permanent self having these experiences. Practicing to let go of the stories and thereby let go of the sense of self is the key to liberation or happiness. As one pundit put it, no self, no problem. Thank you for your kind attention. So now we have some time for discussion or questions. See what this talk brings to mind around happiness or anger or questions about non-self or emptiness. Anyone like to make a comment or have a question?
Thank you. Two things. One, what's the difference between hatred and anger? That's the one thing. And that last comment that you made, no self, no problem. I have a problem with that because if there is no self, there's no you, I think.
Sure. The difference between anger and hatred can be characterized in a couple of ways. Dalai Lama says that anger may have some redeeming features, such as what Jack Kornfield said, that it can teach us the limits and our boundaries and give us some teachings about that, whereas hatred never has anything positive about it. So that would be one difference between anger and hatred. And I think that anger is more readily resolvable than hatred. One of my favorite political cartoons was a picture of a beaker of liquid with a fire underneath it and boiling hot steam coming out. And the fire was fear, the beaker with liquid was ignorance, and the steam, boiling steam coming out, was hatred. So the idea being that fear operates on ignorance to create hatred. And that's something that has helped me a lot, because when I start seeing people who are hating something, I can ask myself, what are they afraid of? Or what are they seeing is true that generally isn't regarded as true? Where are they ignorant, being ignorant? And instead of talking to them about their hatred, talk to them about, or asking them to open up about those things and see if we can point them gently in a different direction. Whereas with anger, I think that's something that generally just rises and falls, whereas hatred is more rooted. In terms of no problem, no self, I think your question points to this difference between the conventional view of self, which we need to operate in society and to do with the things that we do, but to recognize that that is only a partial truth. The ultimate truth part is that there is no permanent, stable, existing me in here. What I consider to be me is just a series of events, a series of experiences that I have, that I take to be personal. I personalize the fact that I'm suffering. I'm suffering. Well, no, there's just this experience of suffering going on. And to the extent that I can depersonalize it that way and see that it's a quality being shared by untold people the world over, and I'm able to let go of it, and it tends to subside for me. So I hope that helps a little bit. It's a difficult topic, sir. Part of the good news from reading this book of Guy Armstrong's that we've been dealing with is that he points out that you don't have to just study about emptiness or non-self alone to try and get this thing. That the wonderful thing about the Buddha's teachings is that they're like a tapestry. And you pull any string and you're going to get the whole shebang. It's all going to come to you because they are all so interwoven and so well connected that if trying to understand emptiness or non-self doesn't seem to agree with you and you'd rather look at one of those other marks of existence like unsatisfactoriness or impermanence, don't worry about it. The aspect of non-self is an integral part of those teachings, and those teachings are an integral part of non-self, so it will all come together.
So I I really enjoyed the whole set. And one thing that really resonated with me is when you spend so much time, for lack of better words, daydreaming, you know, reliving past experiences or trying to envision future experiences, what's going to happen in your life. You're not enjoying where you are at the present time. And, you know, that's something that I'm just recently really starting to work on, is to be in present time. And not just so much when I'm just meditating, you know, mm-hmm. trying to do this throughout my life, mm-hmm. So that I'm not actually missing my life by being focused in the past or future. Yeah. And so that just is really, I really like that. So I thank you for that.
Well, thank you. An example from my days in addiction, I had a friend who had a young daughter who was about 3 or 4 years old, and we'd be sitting around smoking pot, and she'd come up to her dad and put her hand on his knee, look in his eyes, and he would even be trying to respond to her, but she would just look in his eyes and walk away. Nobody's home, you know. You can't be in the present moment when you're high. You can't be in the present moment when you're daydreaming, as you suggest. And that is why we call meditation practice, because we want to be we're practicing being in the present moment while we're sitting in order to be able to experience it 24/7. So, very good. Thank you. Yes?
So, I just want to thank you for, I don't do well when I get unexpected anger at me. And you made the comment earlier that was awesome about, instead of responding back in anger, the damage is already done. Like, so you don't have to respond back in anger. And I've never thought about it like that, because my reaction is to fight or flight. And so I'm going to remember, try my best to remember that, because sometimes when that comes at you quickly, it's hard to remember those good ways to behave. But I'm going to try to remember that, and I have had situations where somebody said to me one time, do you realize that they won? Because you got pissed. And if they wanted to win, they won. Instead, it would have been better to just stay grounded and maybe send them compassion or something like that. But I appreciate that comment that you made.
Thank you. We got any parents out there? Was she saying resonate at all about sometimes reacting a bit with anger and finding out that doesn't really help? And what I was saying about plasticity of the mind applies to that as well, because those are just habits of responding. That doesn't mean we're bad people. They're just habits of responding to anger with anger. And if we can do the practice and investigate when that has happened in the past, relive that and recreate a different experience in our mind as we imagine what happened back then, maybe the next time it won't be the same outcome. And after a while, it will always be, we hopefully will always be able to pause and take that moment to reflect that, well, that's over. Thank you for your comment.
Yeah, my name's Rob. In the last couple of times I blew my cork, one time was at my brother, and I noticed that even though I was really pissed at him, I mean, I didn't have any hatred towards him, but my language was skillful. I was direct and to the point. There was no judgment. There was no name calling. And I was kind of stuck at his house. But eventually that, you know, settled itself out, and we talked privately afterwards. And another time, I had somebody just, you know, at 30 miles an hour pass me at, you know, I could have touched him. And I caught up to him at the light, and I was really pissed at him. But once again, there was no judgment. I was straight and to the point, and then I just let it go. And I know in the past that wouldn't have been the case. I would have been pissed at her and all, you know, whatever gender and economic issues or level and skin color, all of those things would have been, you're all that way kind of thing. But there was none of that. It was just, this situation happened, and afterwards, it was over and done with. So, anyways, thank you. Yeah.
Well, that is the beauty of it, is that when we're able to have that presence of mind, we don't continue to carry that resentment forever or for a long time afterwards, which is definitely suffering. And as we know from our recovery program, it's resentment is one of the real no-nos if we want to stay in recovery and stay sober. So, yeah, not experience. But there is that thing about the righteous anger, you know, that it can be seductive. It can be murderously sweet, as the Buddha said. So we need to stay alert to having that sense of superiority that can accompany it and all of those kinds of things, because it's not helping us at all. To have that sense of anger. So.
Hey, my name is Sam, and I want to thank you for your time. I was having the no self, no problem. I love that, you know. But I'm coming up to this thing in my head where, like, I think you touched on it with the experience, because sometimes it's almost like I have like these two guys up here, and one guy is my chimp. And he's like my body, like, oh, you did that, I'm angry, you know, and it's like a flood and all this. But it's like, there's a guy underneath that sees it, you know, and like that allows that whole process to happen. And I'm also in the 12-step program, and something that happened today, in fact, I was driving home and I was filled with gratitude for my situation. And then after that, I was like I felt blessed, or I was having like, but then the deeper part was like, who cares? I don't like, and then it was like, becoming a guy who doesn't need to be blessed to be okay, a guy who doesn't need to be angry or need to be happy to be okay. And then I guess there, I don't know if there was a question there, but like, sometimes I get caught up in that monkey. I call him my monkey, and he gets real mad and he wants to throw things and smash, you know, or just, do you experience that, or do you have any practices? And, what do you do about it?
Well, not as much as I used to. That's why I'm the anger guy here, is because I had a pretty good run of anger back, angry responses back in the day. And certainly I still have moments where the chimp's going crazy up here. I think the most important strategy that I've developed is the one that you mentioned you have, is that you have awareness of it, that you're able to step back from it and see what it is, and not be reactive to it. In athletics, sometimes they'll say, in baseball, when somebody gets infielder gets a difficult play hit at them and they don't handle it smoothly, they say, oh, the ball played him instead of him playing the ball. And that's that idea of awareness, is that if you can have the awareness of the chimp going nuts up there, you can make choices about what to do, and you can choose freedom. By taking the pause and deciding not to act on it, but just to view it as, oh, that's an interesting thought. That's all it is. It's just a thought. As the Buddha said to Bahaya, just view as a thought as a thought. And that's one of the things that my first temporary sponsor used to say to me when I'd be going on and on about how hard my life was, how nobody understood, and anybody who was going through what I was going through would be blah, 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 blah. And she would just say, that's an interesting thought. That's all it is. Shut up. So, okay. Yes, back here.
I find oftentimes when I step into anger, there's a real deep undertone of shame. I was wondering if you could provide a distinction between the two.
Between anger and shame? Okay. Does it resonate with you to say that that shame manifests as self-hatred and anger? anger and self-hatred kind of going together there? Okay, well, that's what I would see it, is that that's, as I was saying, anger is in a continuum, so is low self-esteem. You can have low self-esteem where sometimes I don't care for myself too much, but sometimes I hate myself. I think I'm the worst thing on earth, and I can't imagine why anybody likes me and how I get by. And that self, I think shame can take us to that place of self-hatred, and that is something we can experience as anger. And once that chimp, as Sam was saying, gets loose in your mind, there's no telling what direction it's going to go. You know, you could be feeling that, experiencing that shame and self-hatred, but you manifest it by acting it out on someone else. So I don't know if that's really a distinction between shame and anger or hatred, but I think they kind of interact that way. Okay. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
So I guess I'm curious, when you're talking about, it seems like the way you presented things tonight, that everything is so transitory. Like, where is there room for goals? Or, like, it seems like you have to have some kind of story going on for something to have meaning. So if a sound is just a sound, or a taste is just a taste, how do you connect experiences together to form meaning? And then I'm also curious about, like, how would you compare no self to true self? Because we always hear, to thine own self be true. And I've been clean for a year, and I find that I can't help but be preoccupied with, like, you know, in all of my years of use, where's my true self inside? And is that just like a pointless pursuit? If you're thinking about it in Buddhist terms, is that just like begging to be unhappy if you're always trying to figure out who you are or what you want to accomplish?
Well, I'll start with the second part first. You might have to remind me of what the first one was. I probably might get done with the second one, okay? The idea of what's the true self is something that in Theravada Buddhism, which is the lineage that we use here at Common Ground, it's called Vipassana, or insight meditation. And that means that we meditate to be calm, but that's not the goal. The belief is that once you are able to obtain that level of calmness and maintain it over a period of time, wisdom will arise, and you will begin to see things that you didn't see before, which is actually one of the promises in the Big Book, that things that used to baffle you will become readily understandable. And so it seemed as though Bill was almost talking about Vipassana meditation when he wrote that particular promise. But that's the idea, is that through this practice and through understanding no self, non-self, that you will develop an understanding of the way things truly are, the way the world really is, and that includes what you truly are, what your true sense of self is, and that these are things that we just need to try and see if it's going to work. The Buddha said, come and see if this works for you, or as we say in recovery, take what works and leave the rest. It's a very similar idea. And that's why I mentioned earlier that doubt is the most pernicious of the hindrances, because it's easy to doubt that, really, this is going to get me to understand my true self just sitting here quietly? And you can see how that can get in the way of sitting there quietly trying to obtain that calmness and concentration that will allow that wisdom of your true self to arise. So from a Christian perspective, Jesus said, the temple of God is within. And similarly, there's this idea of Buddha nature, that we have a heart that is full of compassion and generosity and wisdom. And we just need to clear the mud away, get into the present moment, be calm and relaxed, and the knowledge of those things will arise. What was the first question again? Oh, how do you do planning? Yes, one of the senses is thinking. In Buddhism, there are six senses. There's the five we're used to, plus thought. They consider the mind to be an organ, just like tongue, skin, eyes, ears, and so forth. And so thinking is a sense experience. And so you can be thinking in the present moment about the future, but just aware, oh, I'm planning for the future. And as long as you have that awareness that this is thinking and I'm planning for the future, maybe it'll be that way, maybe planning is God's idea of a joke, who knows, but it's okay. You know, I can be planning for the future as long as I have awareness of it. The problem becomes when we are neurotically just thinking about the future and wishing things would work out this way and work out this way, and we're just ceaselessly doing that without even an awareness that we're doing something called planning. We're just spinning, basically. So that's how I see the idea of Buddhism and thought being, or thinking being, one of our senses, addressing that idea of, well, how do you plan for the future if you're in the present moment? So I hope that helps. Does that resonate? Yeah, good.
Thank you so much. One thing that I have been thinking about lately is how to respond to anger in others. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on a skillful approach to anger that is not within you, but is near you. I'll leave it there.
To an angry other?
Yeah. Oh. Yes.
I think one approach is to recognize, as we say in one of the 12-step programs, that if even one person starts to get better, it affects the whole family or all of the relationships. And so by not responding in kind to that angry other and being able to pause and just realize, oh, that person just had an interesting thought, and it's over now. it's over now, and that feeling that they are wanting me to have, I can choose to not have it by realizing that was just a thought that the person expressed, or just an opinion, and just let it go. And I really think that if we can develop that kind of a response to anger around us, that will put a break on the other person's anger, because they're not getting the response they wanted. We're not playing the game, as I was mentioning earlier about children. They try to get you to go, you know, and if you don't respond that way, it's not the game they wanted. That may work in some situations. Some people, the anger may be so deep that it's just something to get away from. But that's again that continuum of anger question. So hope that helps. Others? Okay, well, we've got just a few minutes here, and we're going to break some new ground at Common Ground, and we're going to end with a song. It's on page 44, and it's called Happiness is Here and Now, which fits quite well with the topic. This is a song that was created by Thich Nhat Hanh and is sung frequently at his main village, Plum Village, in France. And we sing it at residential retreats that Common Ground does at the end. After we've had our closing circle, we sing this song, Happiness is Here Now. So I'll play through it once, and you can get the tune, and then we'll do the two verses, okay? Okay. Thank you.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.